The Mandrake exec shrug. I'm not aware of any limits on the Opern system's growth potential. It may have spread under the whole beach, for all I know.
I think that's unlikely,
said Sun, with the calm of a lab technician in mid-experiment. The remote sensing would have found something that large. And besides, it has not consumed the other sentry robots, which it would if it were spreading laterally. I suspect it opened a gap in our perimeter, and then flowed through in linear...
Look! Said John. It's there!
On the screen over my head, I saw the arms of the thing emerge from the rubble-strewn ground around the gate. Maybe it had already tried to come up from under the foundation and failed. The cables were a good 2 meters from the nearest edge of the plinth when they struck.
Here we fucking go, said Schneider.
No, wait!
This was Wardani, a soft gleam in her voice that could almost have been pride.
Wait and see.
The cables seemed to be having trouble getting a grip on the material the gate was made of. They lashed down, then slid off as if oiled. I watched the process repeat itself half a dozen times, and then drew a sharp breath as another, longer arm erupted from the sand, flailed upward half a dozen meters, and wrapped around the lower slopes of the spire. If the same limb had come up under the Nagini, it could have dragged us out of the sky comfortably. The new cable flexed and tightened and disintegrated. At first, I thought Sun had disregarded my instructions and opened fire again with the ultra-vibe. Then recollection caught up. The nanobes were immune to vibe weapons. The other cables were gone as well.
Sun, what the fuck happened?
I am attempting to ascertain exactly that.
Sun's machine associations were starting to leak into her speech patterns.
It turned it off,
Wardani said simply.
Turned what off? Asked Dupre.
And now I could hear the smile in the archaeologue's voice.
The nanobes exist in an electromagnetic envelope. That's what binds them together. The gate just turned off the field.
Son?
Mistress Wardani appears to be correct. I can detect no electromagnetic activity anywhere near the artifact, and no motion.
The faint hiss of static on the induction rig as everyone digested the confirmation. Then Dupre's voice, thoughtful.
And we're supposed to fly through that thing?
Considering what had gone before, and what was to come on the other side, 0 hour at the gate was remarkably undramatic. At 2.5 minutes to zero, the dripping blobs of ultraviolet we'd seen through Wardani's filigree screen became slowly visible as liquid purple lines playing up and down along the outer edges of the spire. In the daylight, the display was no more impressive than a landing beacon by dawn light. At 18 seconds, something seemed to happen along the recessed foldings. Something like wings being shaken. At 9 seconds, a dense black dot appeared without any fuss at the point of the spire. It was shiny, like a single drop of high-grade lubricant, and it appeared to be rolling around on its own axis. 8 seconds later, it expanded with unhurried smoothness to the base of the spire, and then beyond. The plinth disappeared, and then the sand to a depth of about a meter. In the globe of darkness, stars glimmered.
Part 4. Unexplained Phenomena. Anyone who builds satellites we can't shoot down needs to be taken seriously, and, if they ever come back for their hardware, be approached with caution. That's not religion. It's common sense. Quelchrist Falconer. Metaphysics for Revolutionaries. Chapter 30. I don't like hard space. It fucks with your head. It's not anything physical. You can make more mistakes in space than at the bottom of the ocean, or in a toxic atmosphere like Glimmer Fives. You can get away with far more in a vacuum, and on occasion I have. Stupidity, forgetfulness, and panic will not get you killed with the same implacable certainty as they will in less forgiving environments. But it isn't that. The Harlan's World Orbitals sit 500 kilometers out, and will shoot down anything that masses more than a 6-seater helicopter as soon as look at it. There have been some notable exceptions to this behavior, but so far no one has been able to work out what caused them. As a result, Harlanites don't go up in the air much, and vertigo is as common as pregnancy. The first time I wore a vacuum suit, courtesy of the Protectorate Marines at age 18, my entire mind turned to ice, and looking down through the infinite emptiness, I could hear myself whimpering deep in the back of my throat. It looked like a very long way to fall. Envoy conditioning gives you a handle on most kinds of fear, but you're still aware of what scares you, because you feel the weight of the conditioning coming online. I've felt that weight every single time. In high orbit over Loico during the pilot's revolt, deploying with Randall's vacuum commandos around Adoracion's outer moon, and once, in the depths of interstellar space, playing a murderous game of tag with members of the real estate crew around the hull of the hijacked colony barge Mitsumdi, falling endlessly along her trajectory, light years from the nearest sun. The Mitsumdi fighter was the worst. It still gives me the occasional nightmare. The Nagini slithered through the gap in three-dimensional space the gate had peeled back, and hung amid nothing. I let out the same breath we'd all been holding since the assault ship began inching toward the gate, got out of my seat, and walked forward to the cockpit, bouncing slightly in the adjusted grav field. I could already see the star field on the screen, but I wanted a genuine view through the toughened transparencies of the assault ship's nose. It helps to see your enemy face to face, to sense the void out there a few centimeters from the end of your nose. It helps you to know where you are to the animal roots of your being. It's strictly against the rules of spaceflight to open connecting hatches during entry into hard space. But no one said anything, even when it must have been clear where I was going. I got a strange look from Amelie Vongsavath as I stepped through the hatch, but she didn't say anything either. Then again, she was the first pilot in the history of the human race to effect an instantaneous transfer from a planetary altitude of 6 meters to the middle of deep space, so I suspect she had other things in her mind. I stared forward past her left shoulder, stared down, and felt my fingers curl tight on the back of Vongsavath's seat. Fear confirmed. The old shift in the head, like pressure doors locking sections of my brain up under the diamond-bright illumination. The conditioning. I breathed.
"You're going to stay. You might want to sit down," said Vongsavath,
busy with a buoyancy monitor that had just started gibbering at the sudden lack of a planet beneath us. I clambered to the co-pilot seat and lowered myself into it, looking for the webbing straps. "See anything?" I asked with elaborate calm.
"Stars,"
she said shortly. I waited for a while, getting used to the view, feeling the itch at the outer corners of my eyes as instinct deep reflexes pulled my peripheral vision backward, looking for some end to the intense lack of light. "So how far out are we?" Vongsavath punched up figures on the astrogation set.
"According to this,"
she whistled low,
780-odd million clicks. Believe that?
It put us just inside the orbit of Banharn, the solitary and rather unimpressive gas giant that stood sentinel on the outer edges of the sanctioned system. 300 million kilometers farther in on the ecliptic was a circling sea of rubble, too extensive to be called a belt, that had for some reason never gotten around to coalescing into planetary masses. A couple of 100 million kilometers to the other side of that was Sanction 4, where we'd been about 40 seconds ago. Impressive. All right, a stellar-range needle cast can put you on the other side of so many kilometers that you run out of places to put the zeros in less time than that. But you have to be digitized first, and then you have to be downloaded into a new sleeve at the other end. And all that takes time and technology. It's a process. We hadn't been through a process, or at least nothing humanly recognizable as such. We just bumped across a line. Given inclination and a vacuum suit, I could literally have stepped across that line. Suchiati's sense of not belonging came and touched me again at the nape of the neck. The conditioning awoke and damped it out. The wonder, along with the fear.
"We've stopped," murmured Vongsavath, to herself more than me. "Something soaked up our acceleration. You'd expect some..." "Holy God!"
Her voice, already low,
sank to a whisper on the last two words and seemed to decelerate the way that a genie apparently had. I looked up from the figure she'd just maximized on the display, and my first thought, still scrabbling around in a planet-bound context, was that we had cruised into a shadow. By the time I remembered that there were no mountains out here, and not much in the way of sunlight to be obscured anyway, the same chilly shock that Vongsavath must have been feeling hit me. Over our heads, the stars were sliding away. They disappeared silently, swallowed with terrifying speed by the vast, occluding bulk of something hanging, it seemed, only meters above the overhead viewports. "That's it," I said, and a small, cold shiver ran through me as I said it, as if I'd just completed an obscure summoning.
"Range?"
Vongsavath shook her head.
"It's nearly 5 kilometers off. That makes it..."
27 kilometers across. I read out the data myself. 53 long, external structures extending... I gave up. "Big. Very big."
"Isn't it?"
Ordani's voice came from right behind me.
"See the crenellation at the edge? Each of those bites is nearly a kilometer deep."
"Why don't I just sell seats in here?" snapped Vongsavath.
"Mistress Wardani, will you please return to the cabin and sit down?" "Sorry,"
murmured the archaeologue.
"I was just..."
Sirens. A spaced scream slashing at the air in the cockpit.
"Incoming!"
yelled Vongsavath, and kicked the Najini on end. It was a maneuver that would have hurt in a gravity well, but with only the ship's own grav field exerting force, it felt more like an Xperia special effect, an Angel Wharf Conjurer's trick with hollow shift. Vacuum combat fragments. I saw the missile coming, falling end over end toward the right side vision ports. I heard the battle systems reporting for duty in their cozily enthusiastic machine voices. Shouts from the cabin behind me. I started to tense. The conditioning broke in heavily, forced me into impact-ready limpness. "Just a minute."
"That can't be right,"
Vongsavath said suddenly. "You don't see missiles in space. Even the ones we can build move too fast for a human eye to track effectively."
"No impact threat,"
observed the battle computer, sounding slightly disappointed.
"No impact threat."
"It's barely moving."
Vongsavath punched up a new screen, shaking her head.
"Axial velocity at... Ah, that's just drift, man."
"Those are still machine components," I said, pointing at a small spike in the red section of the spectrum scan. "Circuitry, maybe. It ain't a rock. Not just a rock, anyway."
"It's not active, though. Totally inert. Let me run the..."
"Why don't you just bring us around and back up?" I made a quick calculation in my head. "About 100 meters. It'll be practically sitting out there in the windshield. Kick on the external lights." Vongsavath locked onto me with a look that somehow managed to combine disdain with horror. It wasn't exactly a flight manual recommendation. More importantly, she probably still had the adrenaline chops sloshing about in her system the same as me. It's apt to make you grumpy.
"Coming about,"
she said finally. Outside the viewports, the environment lighting ignited. In a way, it wasn't such a great idea. The toughened transparent alloy of the vision ports would have been built to vacuum combat spec, which means stopping all but the most energetic micrometeorites without much more than surface pitting. Certainly it wasn't about to be ruined by bumping into something adrift. But the thing that came bumping up over the nose of the Najini made an impact anyway. Behind me, Tanya Wardani shrieked, a short, quickly locked-up sound. Scorched and ruptured though it was by the extremes of cold and the absence of pressure outside, the object was still recognizable as a human body, dressed for summer on the Dangrek coast.
"Holy God!"
whispered Vongsavath again. A blackened face peered sightlessly in at us, empty eye sockets masked in trailing strands of exploded frozen tissue. The mouth below was all scream, as silent now as it would have been when its owner tried to find a voice for the agony of dissolution. Beneath a ludicrously loud summer shirt, The body was swollen by a bulk that I guessed were the ruptured intestines and stomach. One clawed hand bumped knuckles on the viewport. The other arm was jerked back over the head. The legs were similarly flexed, forward and back. Whoever it was had died flailing at the vacuum, died falling. Behind me, Wardani was sobbing quietly, saying a name. We found the rest of them by suit beacons, floating at the bottom of a 300-meter dimple in the hull structure, and clustered around what appeared to be a docking portal. There were four, all wearing cheap pull-on vacuum suits. From the look of it, three had died when their air supply ran out, which according to suit specs would have taken about 6 to 8 hours. The fourth one hadn't wanted to wait that long. There was a neat 5-centimeter hole melted through the suit's helmet from right to left. The industrial laser cutter that had done the damage was still tethered to the right hand at the wrist. Vong Savath sent out the Mandagrab-equipped EVA robot once again. We watched the screens in silence as the little machine collected each corpse in its arms and bore it back to the Nagini with the same gentle deftness of touch it had applied to the blackened and ruptured remains of Tomas Dasanapangsakul at the gate. This time, with the bodies enfolded in the white wrap of their vacuum suits, it could almost have been footage of a funeral run in reverse. The dead carried back out of the deep and consigned to the Nagini's ventral airlock. Wardani could not cope. She came down to the hold deck with the rest of us while Vong Savath blew the inner hatch on the airlock from the flight deck. She watched Suchiati and Luke Dupre bring the vacuum-suited bodies up. But when Dupre broke the seals of the first helmet and lifted it off the features beneath, she uttered a choked sob and spun away to the far corner of the hold. I heard her retching. The acid reek of vomit stung the air. Schneider went after her. "You know this one, too?" I asked redundantly, staring down at the dead face. It was a woman in a mid-40s sleeve, eyes wide and accusatory. She was frozen solid, neck protruding stiffly from the ring of the suit aperture, head lifting rigidly clear of the deck. The heating elements of the suit must have taken a while longer to give out than the air supply. If this woman was part of the same team that we'd found in the trawl net, she'd been out here for at least a year. They don't make suits with that kind of survivability. Schneider answered for the archaeologue.
"It's Araboo. Farron Torn Araboo, glyph specialist on the Dangrik dig."
I nodded at Dupre. He unsealed the other helmets and detached them. The dead stared up at us in a line, heads lifted as if in the midst of some group abdominal workout. Araboo and three male companions. Only the suicide's eyes were closed, features composed in an expression of such peace that you wanted to check again for the slick cauterized hole this man had bored through his own skull. Looking at him, I wondered what I would have done. Seeing the gate slam shut behind me, knowing at that moment that I was going to die out here in the dark. Knowing, even if a fast rescue ship was dispatched immediately to these exact coordinates, that rescue would come months too late. I wondered if I would have had the courage to wait, hanging in the infinite night, hoping against hope for some miracle to occur. Or the courage not to. "That's Wang." Schneider had come back and was hovering at my shoulder. "Can't remember his other name. He was some kind of glyph theorist, too. I don't know the others." I glanced across the deck to where Tanya Wardani was huddled against the hull wall, arms wrapped around herself.
"Why don't you leave her alone?" hissed Schneider.
I shrugged. "Okay. Luke, you'd better go back down to the lock and get Dasanapangsakul bagged before he starts to drip. Then the rest of them. I'll give you a hand. Son, can we get the buoy overhauled? Suchiati, maybe you can help her. I'd like to know if we're actually going to be able to deploy the fucking thing." Sun nodded gravely. "Hand, you'd better start thinking of contingencies, because if the buoy's fucked, we're going to need an alternative plan of action."
"Wait a minute."
Schneider looked genuinely scared for the first time since I'd met him.
"We're staying around here? After what happened to these people, we're staying?"
"We don't know what happened to these people, Schneider."
"Isn't it obvious? The gate isn't stable. It shut down on them."
"That's bullshit, Jan."
There was an old strength trickling through the rasp in Wardani's voice, a tone that made something flare up in my stomach. I looked back at her, and she was on her feet again, wiping her face clean of the tears and vomit specks with the heel of one palm.
"We opened it last time, and it stood for days. There's no instability in the sequencing, Aran, then or now."
"Tanya!"
Schneider looked suddenly betrayed. He spread his hands wide.
"I mean, I don't know what happened here. I don't know what..."
She squeezed out the words.
"Fucked up. The glyph sequences Araboa used. But it isn't going to happen to us. I know what I'm doing."
"With respect, Mistress Waradani."
Suchiate looked around at the assembled faces, gauging support.
"You've admitted that our knowledge of this artifact is incomplete. I fail to see how you can guarantee..."
"I am a guild master."
Wardani stalked back toward the lined-up corpses, eyes flaring. It was as if she were furious with them all for getting killed.
"This woman was not. Wing Xiaodong was not. Thomas Tassanapongsakul was not. These people were scratchers. Talented, maybe, but that is not enough. I have over 70 years of experience in the field of Martian archaeology, and if I tell you that the gate is stable, then it is stable."
She glared around her, eyes bright, corpses at her feet. No one seemed disposed to argue the point. The poisoning from the Sabreville blast was gathering force in my cells. It took longer to deal with the bodies than I'd expected, certainly longer than it ought to have taken any ranking officer in Carrera's Wedge. And when the corpse locker hinged slowly shut afterward, I felt wrung out. Dupre, if he felt the same, wasn't showing it. Maybe the Maori sleeves were holding up according to spec. He wandered across the hold to where Schneider was showing Jiang Zhanpeng some kind of trick with a grav harness. I hesitated for a moment, then turned away and headed for the ladder to the upper deck, hoping to find Tanya Wardani in the forward cabin. Instead, I found Hand, watching the vast bulk of the Martian starship roll past below us on the cabin's main screen. "Take some getting used to, huh?" There was a greedy enthusiasm in the executive's voice as he gestured at the view. The Najini's environment lights provided illumination for a few hundred meters in all directions, but as the structure faded away into the darkness, you were still aware of it, sprawling across the starfield. It seemed to go on forever, curving out at odd angles and sprouting appendages like bubbles about to burst, defying the eye to put limits on the darkness it carved out. You stared and thought you had the edge of it. You saw the faint glimmer of stars beyond. Then the fragments of light faded or jumped, and you saw that what you thought was starfield was just an optical trick on the face of more bulking shadow. The colony hulks of the Conrad Harlan fleet were among the largest mobile structures ever built by human science, but they could have served this vessel as lifeboats. Even the habitats in the new Beijing system didn't come close. This was a scale we weren't ready for yet. The Najini hung over the starship like a gull over one of the bulk freighters that plied the New Pest to Millsport Belloweed runs. We were an irrelevance, a tiny, uncomprehending visitor along for the ride. I dropped into the seat opposite Hand and swiveled it so that I faced the screen, feeling shivery in the hands and the spine. Shifting the corpses had been cold work, and when we bagged Dasanapongsakul, the frozen strands of eye tissue branching like coral from his emptied sockets had broken off onto the plastic, under the palm of my hand. I felt them give through the bag. I heard the brittle crickling noise they made. That tiny sound, the little chirrup of death's particular consequences, had shunted aside most of my earlier awe at the massive dimensions of the Martian vessel. "Just a bigger version of a colony barge," I said. "Theoretically, we could have built that big. It's just harder to accelerate all that mass."
"Obviously not for them."
"Obviously not."
"So you think that's what it was? A colony ship?"
I shrugged, striving for a casualness I wasn't feeling. "There are a limited number of reasons for building something this big. It's either hauling something somewhere or you live in it. And it's hard to see why you'd build a habitat this far out. There's nothing here to study. Nothing to mine or skim.
It's hard to see why you'd park it here as well, if it is a colony barge.
Crick, crickle. I closed my eyes. Why do you care, Hand? When we get back, this thing's going to disappear into some corporate asteroid dock. None of us will ever see it again. Why bother getting attached? You'll get your percentage, your bonus, or whatever it is that powers you up.
You think I'm not curious?
I think you don't care. He said nothing after that until Sun came up from the hold deck with the bad news. The buoy, it appeared, was irreparably damaged.
It signals, she said, and with some work the drives can be re-engaged. It needs a new power core, but I believe I can modify one of the bike generators to do the job. But the locational systems are wrecked, and we do not have the tools or material to repair them. Without this, the buoy cannot keep station. Even the backwash from our own drives would probably kick it away into space. What about deploying after we fired our drives?
Hand looked from Sun to myself and back.
Vong Savath can calculate a trajectory and nudge us forward, then drop the buoy when we're in.
Ah. Motion, I finished for him. The residual motion it picks up from when we toss it is still going to be enough to make it drift away. Right, Sun?
That is correct. And if we attach it?
I grinned mirthlessly. Attach it? Weren't you there when the nanobes tried to attach themselves to the gate?
We'll have to look for a way, he said doggedly. We are not going home empty-handed. Not when we've come this close.
You try welding to that thing out there, and we won't be going home at all, Hand. You know that.
Then?
Suddenly he was shouting at us.
There has to be another solution. There is.
Tanya Wardani stood in the hatch to the cockpit, where she had retreated while the corpses were dealt with. She was still pale from her vomiting, and her eyes looked bruised. But underlying it there was an almost ethereal calm I hadn't seen since we brought her out of the camp.
Mistress Wardani?
Hand looked up and down the cabin, as if to check who else had witnessed the loss of cool. He pressed thumb and forefinger to his eyes.
You have something to contribute. Yes. If Sun Li Ping can repair the power systems of the buoy, we can certainly place it.
Place it where? I asked. She smiled thinly.
Inside.
There was a moment's silence. Inside. I nodded at the screen and the unreeling kilometers of alien structure. That?
Yes. We go in through the docking bay and leave the buoy somewhere secure. There's no reason to suppose the hull isn't radio-transparent, at least in places. Most Martian architecture is. We can test broadcast anyway until we find a suitable place.
Sun. Hand was looking back at the screen, almost dreamily.
How long would it take you to effect repairs on the power system? About 8 to 10 hours. No more than 12, certainly.
Sun turned to the archaeologue.
How long will it take you, Mistress Wardani, to open the docking bay? Oh!
Wardani gave us all another strange smile.
It's already open.
I only had one chance to speak to her before we prepared to dock. I met her on her way out of the ship's toilet facilities, 10 minutes after the abrupt and dictatorial briefing Hand had thrown down for everyone. She had her back to me, and we bumped awkwardly in the narrow dimensions of the entryway. She turned with a yelp, and I saw there was a slight sweat still beading her forehead, presumably from more retching. Her breath smelled bad, and stomach acid odors crept out the door behind her. She saw the way I was looking at her.
What?
Are you all right?
No, Kovach. I'm dying. How about you?
You sure this is a good idea?
Oh, not you as well. I thought we'd nailed this down with Suchiati and Schneider.
I said nothing, just watched the hectic light in her eyes. She sighed.
Look, if it satisfies Hand and gets us home again, I'd say yes, it is a good idea. And it's a damned sight safer than trying to attach a defective buoy to the hull.
I shook my head. That's not it.
No?
No. You want to see the inside of this thing before Mandrake spirits it away to some covert dry dock. You want to own it, even if it's only for a few hours. Don't you?
You don't?
I think, apart from Suchiati and Schneider, we all do. I knew Cruikshank would have. I could see the shine in her eyes at the thought of it. The awakening enthusiasm she'd had at the rail of the trawler. The same wonder I'd seen on her face when she looked at the activated gate countdown in the UV backwash. Maybe that was why I wasn't protesting beyond this muttered conversation amid the curling odor of exhausted vomiting. Maybe this was something I owed.
Well, then?
Ordani shrugged.
What's the problem?
You know what the problem is. She made an impatient noise and moved to get past me. I stayed put.
You want to get out of my way, Kovach?
She hissed.
We're 5 minutes off landing, and I need to be in the cockpit.
Why didn't they go in, Tanya?
We've been over...
That's bullshit, Tanya. Amelie's instruments show a breathable atmosphere. They found a way to open the docking system, or they found it already open. And then they waited out here to die while the air in their suits ran out. Why didn't they go in?
You were at the briefing. They had no food. They had...
Yeah, I heard you come up with meters and meters of whole-cloth rationale, but what I didn't hear was anything that explains why four archaeologues would rather die in their spacesuits than spend their last hours wandering around the greatest archaeological find in the history of the human race. For a moment, she hesitated, and I saw something of the woman from the waterfall. Then the feverish light flickered back on in her eyes.
Why ask me? Why don't you just power up one of the ID&A sets and fucking ask them? They're stack intact, aren't they?
The ID&A sets are fucked, Tanya. Leak corroded with the buoys. So I'm asking you again. Why didn't they go in? She was silent again, looking away. I thought I saw a tremor at the corner of one eye. Then it was gone. And she looked up at me with the same dry calm I'd seen in the camp.
I don't know,
she said finally.
And if we can't ask them, then there's only one other way to find out that I can think of.
Yeah. I propped myself away from her warily. And that's what this is about, isn't it? Finding out. Uncovering history. Carrying the fucking torch of human discovery. You're not interested in the money. You don't care who ends up with the property rights, and you certainly don't mind dying. So why should anybody else, right? She flinched, but it was momentary. She locked it down. And then she was turning away, leaving me looking at the pale light from the aluminum tile where she had been pressed. Chapter 31. It was like delirium. I remember reading somewhere that when the archaeologues on Mars first got into the buried mausoleum spaces they later categorized as cities, a fair percentage of them went insane. Mental collapse was an occupational hazard of the profession back then. Some of the finest minds of the century were sacrificed in pursuit of the keys to Martian civilization. Not broken and dragged down to raving insanity the way the archetypal anti-heroes of Xperia horror flicks always end up. Not broken, just blunted. Worn down from the sharp edge of intellectual prowess to a slightly numb, slightly blurred, distracted vagueness. They went that way in their dozens. Psychically abraded by the constant contact with the leavings of unhuman minds. The guild spent them like surgical blades rammed against a spinning grindstone.
"Well, I suppose if you can fly," said Luke Dupre, eyeing the architecture ahead without enthusiasm.
His stance telegraphed irritated confusion. I guessed he was having the same problem locking down potential ambush corners that I was. When the combat conditioning goes in that deep, not being able to do what they've trained you to itches like quitting nicotine. And spotting ambush in Martian architecture would have to be like trying to catch a Mitchum's Point slictopus with your bare hands. From the ponderously overhanging lintel that led out of the docking bay, the internal structure of the ship burst up and around us like nothing I had ever seen. Groping after comparison, my mind came up with an image from my Nupes childhood. One spring out on the deep side of Harada's reef, I'd given myself a bad scare when the feed tube on my scrounged and patched scuba suit snagged on an outcrop of coral 15 meters down. Watching oxygen explode out through the rupture in a riot of silver-bellied corpuscles, I'd wondered fleetingly what the storm of bubbles must look like from the inside. Now, I knew.
These bubbles were frozen in place. Tinged mother-of-pearl shades of blue and pink, where indistinct low-light sources glowed under their surfaces. But aside from that basic difference in longevity, they were as chaotic as my escaping air supply had been that day. There appeared to me no architectural rhyme or reason to the way they joined and merged into each other. In places, the link was a hole only meters across. Elsewhere, the curving walls simply broke their sweep as they met an intersecting circumference. At no point in the first space we entered was the ceiling less than 20 meters overhead.
"The floor is flat, though," murmured Sun Li Ping, kneeling to brush at the sheen's surface underfoot. "And they have grav generators."
"Origin of species."
Tanya Wardani's voice boomed slightly in the cathedric emptiness.
"They evolved in a gravity well, just like us. Zero-G isn't healthy long-term, no matter how much fun it is. And if you have gravity, you need flat surfaces to put things down on. Practicality at work. Same as the docking bay back there. All very well wanting to stretch your wings, but you need straight lines to land a spaceship."
We all glanced back at the gap we'd come through. Compared to where we stood now, the alien curvatures of the docking station had been practically demure. Long, stepped walls tapered outward like 2-meter-fat sleeping serpents, stretched out and laid not quite directly on top of each other. The coils wove just barely off a straight axis, as if even within the strictures of the docking station's purpose, the Martian shipwrights had not quite been able to restrain themselves from an organic flourish. There was no danger involved in bringing a docking vessel down through the increasing levels of atmospheric density, held in by some mechanism in the stepped walls, but looking out to the sides, you still felt you were being lowered into the belly of something sleeping. Delirium. I could feel it brushing lightly at the upper extremities of my vision, sucking gently at my eyeballs and leaving me with a faintly swollen feeling behind the brow. A little like the cut-rate virtualities you used to get in arcades back when I was a kid. The ones where the construct wouldn't let your character look up more than a few degrees above the horizontal, even when that was where the next stage of the game was taking you. It was the same feeling here. The promise of a dull ache behind the eyes from constantly trying to see what was up there. An awareness of space overhead that you kept wanting to check on. The curve on the gleaming surfaces around us put a tilt on it all. A vague sense that you were about to topple over sideways and that, in fact, toppled over and lying down might be the best stance to take in this gratingly alien environment. That this whole ridiculous structure was eggshell thin and ready to crack apart if you did the wrong thing, and that it might easily spill you out into the void. Delirium. Better get used to it. The chamber was not empty. Skeletal arrangements of what looked like scaffolding loomed on the edges of the level floor space. I recalled hollow-shot images in a download I'd scanned as a child. Martian roosting bars, complete with virtually generated Martians roosting on them. Here, somehow, the emptiness of the bars gave each structure an eerie gauntness that did nothing for the creeping unease on the nape of my neck.
"They've been folded down," murmured Wardani, staring upward.
She looked puzzled. At the lower curves of the bubble wall, machines whose functions I couldn't even guess at stood beneath the apparently tidied-away roost bars. Most of them looked spiny and aggressive, but when the archaeologue brushed past one, it did nothing more than mutter to itself and pettishly rearrange some of its spines. Plastic rattle and swift-scaling wine armament deployed in every pair of hands across the hollow bell of the chamber.
"Oh, for God's sake!"
Wardani barely spared us a backward glance.
"Loosen up, will you? It's asleep. It's a machine."
I put up the Kalashnikovs and shrugged. Across the chamber, Dupre caught my eye and grinned.
"A machine for what?" Han wanted to know.
This time the archaeologue did look around.
"I don't know," she said tiredly. "Give me a couple of days and a fully equipped lab team. Maybe I could tell you. Right now, all I can tell you is that it's dormant."
Suchiati took a couple of steps closer, sunjet still raised.
"How can you tell that?"
"Because if it wasn't, we'd already be dealing with it on an interactive basis, believe me. Plus, can you see anybody with wing spurs rising a meter above their shoulders, putting an active machine that close to a curved wall? I'm telling you, this whole place is powered down and packed up.
Mistress Wardani appears to be correct, said Sun, pivoting about with the Nuanovic survey set on her forearm raised. There is detectable circuitry in the walls, but most of it is inactive.
There must be something running all this.
Amelie Vongsavath stood with her hands in her pocket and stared up into the drafty heights at the center of the chamber.
We have breathable air. A bit thin, but it's warm. Come to that. This whole place has to be heated somehow. Caretaker systems.
Tanya Wardani seemed to have lost interest in the machines. She wandered back to the group.
A lot of the deeper buried cities on Mars and Necroma's land had them, too.
After this long?
Suchiati didn't sound happy. Wardani sighed. She jerked a thumb at the docking bay entrance.
It's not witchcraft, Captain. You've got the same thing running the Najini for us back there. If we all die, she'll sit there for a good few centuries waiting for someone to come back.
Yes, and if it's someone who doesn't have the codes, she'll blast them into soup. That doesn't reassure me, Mistress Wardani.
Well, maybe that's the difference between us and the Martians. A little civilized sophistication.
And longer-lasting batteries, I said. This has all been here a lot longer than the Najini's good for.
What's the radio transparency like? Asked Hand.
Sun did something to the new Anovic system she was wearing. The bulkier shoulder-mounted sections of the survey equipment flickered. Symbols evolved in the air over the back of her hand. She shrugged.
It's not very good. I'm barely picking up the Najini's navigational beacon, and she's only on the other side of the wall. Shielding, I suppose. We are in a docking station and close to the hull. I think we will need to move further in.
I spotted a couple of alarmed glances flicker back and forth among the group. Dupre caught me watching, and he smiled a little.
So, who wants to explore?
He asked softly.
I don't think that's such a good idea, said Hand.
I moved out from the instinctive defensive huddle we'd all formed, stepped through the gap between two roost bars, and reached up to the lip of the opening above and behind. Waves of tiredness and faint nausea shimmered through me as I hauled myself up, but by now I was expecting it, and the Nurikem locked it down. The hollow beyond was empty, not even dust. Maybe it's not such a good idea, I agreed, dropping back. But how many human beings this side of the next millennium are going to get this chance? You need 10 hours, right, son?
At the most.
And you reckon you can build us a decent map on that thing? I gestured at the Nuanovic set.
Very probably. This is the best survey software money can buy.
She bowed briefly in Han's direction.
Nuanovic smart systems. They don't build it better than this.
I looked over to Amelie Vongsavath. And the Najini's weapon systems are powered up solid. The pilot nodded.
Parameters I gave, she could stand off a full tactical assault with no help from us.
Well then, I'd say we got a day pass to the Coral Castle. I glanced at Suchiati. Those of us who want it, that is. Looking around, I saw the idea taking hold. The prey was already there, face and stance betraying his curiosity, but it was slowly filling up the rest of them, too. Everywhere, heads were tilted back to take in the alien architecture, features iron soft by wonder. Even Suchiati couldn't hold it off completely. The grim watchfulness he'd maintained since we breached the upper levels of the docking chamber's layered atmosphere field was melting into something less clamped down. The fear of the unknown was ebbing, cancelled out by something stronger and older. Monkey curiosity. The trait I'd disparaged to Wardani when we arrived on the beach at Sabreville. The scampering, chittering jungle intelligence that would cheerfully scale the brooding figures of ancient stone idols and poke fingers into the staring eye sockets just to see. The bright obsidian desire to know. The thing that's dragged us out here, all the way from the grasslands of Central Africa. The thing that one day'll probably put us somewhere so far out that we'll get there ahead of the sunlight from those Central African days. Hans stepped into the center,
poised in executive mode. "Let's achieve some sense of priority here," he said carefully. "I sympathize with any wish you may all have to see some of this vessel. I would like to see it myself. But our major concern is to find a safe transmission base for the buoy. That we must do before anything else, and I suggest we do it as a single unit." He turned to Suchiati. "After that, we can detail exploratory parties. Captain?" Suchiati nodded, but it was an uncharacteristically vague motion. Like the rest of us, he wasn't really paying attention at human frequencies anymore. If there'd been any lingering doubts about the Martian vessel's hulk status, a couple of hours in the frozen bubbles of its architecture was enough to cancel them out. We walked for over a kilometer, winding back and forth through the apparently random connections between chambers. In places, the openings were more or less at floor level, but elsewhere they were cut high enough that Ordani or Sun had to power up the grav harnesses they were wearing and float up to peer through. Zhang and Dupre took point together, splitting and edging up to the entrance to each new chamber with quiet, symmetrical lethality. We found nothing recognizably living. The machines we came across ignored us, and no one seemed inclined to get close enough to elicit more of a reaction. Increasingly, as we moved deeper into the body of the ship, we began to find structures that might, by a stretch of the imagination, be called corridors. Long, bulbous spaces with egg-shaped entrances led in at either end. It looked like the same construction technique as the standard bubble chamber, modified to suit. "You know what this whole thing is?" I told Wardani, while we waited for Sun to scout out another overhead opening. "It's like air gel. Like they built a basic framework and then just..." I shook my head. The concept stubbornly resisted chiseling out into words. "I don't know, just blew up a few cubic kilometers of heavy-duty air gel base all over it and then waited for it to harden." Wardani smiled wanly.
"Yeah, maybe. Something like that. That would put their plasticity science a little ahead of ours, wouldn't it? To be able to map and model foam data on this scale."
"Maybe not." I groped at the opening shape of the idea, feeling at its origami edges. "Out here, specific structure wouldn't matter. Whatever came out would do. And then you just fill the space with whatever you need. Drivers, environmental systems, you know, weapons."
"Weapons?"
She looked at me with something unreadable in her face.
"Does this have to be a warship?"
"No, it was an example, but..."
"Something in here," said Sun over the comset. "Some kind of tree or..."
What happened next was hard to explain. I heard the sound coming. I knew with utter certainty that I was going to hear it fractions of a second before the low chime floated down out of the bubble Sun was exploring. The knowledge was a solid sensation, heard like an echo cast backward against the slow decay of passing time. If it was the envoy intuition, it was working at a level of efficiency I'd only previously run into in dreams.
"Song spire," said Wardani.
I listened to the echoes fade, inverting the shiver of premonition I just felt, and suddenly wanted very much to be back on the other side of the gate, facing the mundane dangers of the nanobe systems and the fallout from murdered Somerville.
Cherries and mustard. An inexplicable tangle of scents spilling down in the wake of the sound.
Zhang raised his sunjet. Suchiati's normally immobile features creased. "What is that?" "Song spire," I said, spinning matter-of-factness around my own creeping unease. "Kind of Martian houseplant. I'd seen one once, for real, on Earth. Dug out of the Martian bedrock it had grown from over the previous several thousand years, and plinthed as a rich man's objet d'art. Still singing when anything touched it, even the breeze. Still giving out the cherry and mustard aroma. Not dead, not alive. Not anything that could be categorized into a box by human science."
"How is it attached?"
Wardani wanted to know.
"Growing out of the wall."
Sun's voice came back, dented with a by now familiar wonder.
"Like some kind of coral."
Wardani stepped back to give herself launch space, and reached for the drives on her own grav harness. The quick whine of power-up stung the air.
"I'm coming up."
Just a moment, Mistress Wardani. Han glided into Crowder. Son, is there a way through up there?
No. Hole bubbles closed.
Then come back down. He raised a hand to forestall Wardani. We do not have time for this. Later, if you wish, you may come back while Sun is repairing the buoy. For now, we must find a safe transmission base before anything else.
A vaguely mutinous expression broke across the archaeologue's face, but she was too tired to sustain it. She knocked out the grav drivers again, down whining machine disappointment, and turned away. Something muttered and bitten off, drifting back over her shoulder, almost as faint as the cherries and mustard from above. She stalked the line away from the Mandrake exec toward the exit. Jiang hesitated a moment in her path, then let her by. I sighed.
Nice going, Hand. She's the closest thing we've got to a native guide in this, I gestured around, place, and you want to piss her off. They teach you that while you were getting your conflict investment doctorate? Upset the experts if you possibly can?
No, he said evenly, but they taught me not to waste time.
Right. I went after Wardani and caught up just inside the corridor leading out of the chamber. Hey, hold up, Wardani? Wardani, just chill out, will you? Man's an asshole. What are you going to do?
Fucking merchant.
Well, yeah, that too. But he is the reason we're here in the first place. Should never underestimate that mercantile drive.
What are you, a fucking economics philosopher now?
I stopped. Listen.
No, I'm through with...
No, listen. I held up a hand and pointed down the corridor.
There. Hear that? I don't hear...
Her voice trailed off as she caught it. By then, the Carrera's wedge Nurikamen reeled in the sound for me, so clear there could be no question. Somewhere down the corridor, something was singing. Two chambers farther on, we found them. A whole bonsai song spire forest, sprouting across the floor and up the lower curve of a corridor neck where it joined the main bubble. The spires seemed to have broken through the primary structure of the vessel from the floor around the join, although there was no sign of damage at their roots. It was as if the hull material had closed around them like healing tissue. The nearest machine was a respectful 10 meters off, huddled down the corridor. The song the spires emitted was closest to the sound of a violin, but played with the infinitely slow drag of individual monofilaments across the bridge, and to no melody that I could discern. It was a sound down at the lowest levels of hearing, but each time it swelled, I felt something tugging at the pit of my stomach.
The air,
Wardani said quietly. She had raced me along the bulbous corridors and through the bubble chambers, and now she crouched in front of the spires, out of breath, but shiny-eyed.
There must be convection through here from another level. They only sing on surface contact.
I shook off an unlooked-for shiver. How old do you reckon they are?
Who knows?
She got to her feet again.
If this were a planetary grav field, I'd say a couple of thousand years at most. But it isn't.
She took a step back and shook her head, hand cupping her chin, fingers pressed over her mouth as if to keep in a too hasty comment. I waited. Finally, the hand came away from her face and gestured, hesitant.
Look at the branching pattern. They don't usually grow like this. Not this twisted.
I followed her pointing finger. The tallest of the spires stood about chest high, spindly reddish-black stone limbs snaking out of the central trunk in a profusion that did seem more exuberant and intricate than the growth I'd seen on the plinth specimen back on Earth. Surrounding it, other smaller spires emulated the pattern, except that the rest of the party caught up, to pray in hand in the van.
Where the hell have you...
Oh. The faint singing from the spires crept up an almost imperceptible increment. Air currents stirred by the movement of bodies across the chamber. I felt a slight dryness in my throat at the sound they made.
I'm just looking at these, if that's okay, Hand.
Mistress Wardani.
I shot the exec a warning glance.
Dupre came up beside the archaeologue.
Are they dangerous?
I don't know. Ordinarily, no, but...
The thing that had been scratching for attention at the threshold of my consciousness suddenly emerged. They're growing toward each other. Look at the branches on the smaller ones. They all reach up and out. The taller ones branch in all directions.
That suggests communication of some sort. An integrated self-relating system.
Sun walked around the cluster of spires, scanning with the emissions tracer on her arm.
Though, you won't find any radiation,
said Wardani, almost dreamily.
They suck it in like sponges. Total absorption of everything except red wave light. According to mineral composition, the surface of these things shouldn't be red at all. They ought to reflect right across the spectrum.
But they don't. Hand made it sound as if he were thinking of having the spires detained for the transgression. Why is that, Mistress Wardani?
If I knew that, I'd be a guild president by now. We know less about song spires than practically any other aspect of the Martian biosphere. In fact, we don't even know if you can rank them in the biosphere.
They grow, don't they? I saw Wardani sneer.
So do crystals. That doesn't make them alive.
I don't know about the rest of you, said Amelie Vongsavath, skirting the song spires with her sunjet cocked at a semi-aggressive angle.
But this looks to me like an infestation.
Or art,
murmured Dupre.
How would we know?
Vongsavath shook her head.
This is a ship look. You don't put your corridor art where you'll trip over it every time you walk through. Look at these things. They're all over the place.
And if you can fly through?
They'd still get in the way.
Collision art, suggested Schneider with a smirk.
All right, that's enough. Hand waved himself some space between the spires and their new audience. Faint notes awoke as the motion brushed air currents against the redstone branches. The musk in the air thickened.
We do not have time for this,
droned Wardani.
We must find a safe transmission base.
Schneider guffawed. I bit back a grin and avoided looking into Prey's direction. I suspected that Hand's control was crumbling, and I wasn't keen to push him over the edge at this point. I still wasn't sure what he'd do when he snapped. Son? The Mandrake exec's voice came out even enough. Check the upper openings. The system specialist nodded and powered up her grav harness. The whine of the drivers cut in, and then deepened as her boot soles unstuck from the floor, and she drifted upward. Zhang and Dupre circled out, sunjets raised to cover her.
No way through here,
she called back down from the first opening. I heard the change, and my eyes slanted back to the song spires. Wardani was the only one watching me, and she saw my face. Behind Hand's back, her mouth opened in a silent question. I nodded at the spires and cupped my ear. Listen. Wardani moved closer, then shook her head, hissing.
That's not pus.
But it was. The faint violin-scraped sound of the song was modulating, reacting to the constant underpinning drone of the grav drivers. That, or maybe the grav field itself, modulating, and very faintly, strengthening, waking up. Chapter 32. We found Han's safe transmission base 4 Songspire clusters and about another hour later. By then, we'd started to hook back toward the docking bay, following a tentative map that Sun's Nuinovic scanners were building on her arm. The mapping software didn't like Martian architecture any more than I did. That much was apparent from the long pauses every time Sun loaded in a new set of data. But with a couple of hours wandering behind us, and some inspired interfacing from the systems specialist, the program was able to start making some educated guesses of its own about where we should be looking. Perhaps, not surprisingly, it was dead right. Climbing out of a massive, spiraling tube whose gradient was too steep for human comfort, Sun and I staggered to a halt at the edge of a 50-meter-broad platform that was seemingly exposed to raw space on all sides. A crystal-clear, open starfield curved overhead and down around us, interrupted only by the bones of a gaunt central structure reminiscent of a Millsport dockyard crane. The sense of exposure to the outside was so complete, I felt my throat lock up momentarily in vacuum combat reflex at the sight. My lungs, still straining from